Justice for the human family, we demand it. Justice, truth, freedom, equality, a must. Us decolonization of the planet. So bust this. People be the power, now we build the justice. Pointing at system divinations, how we build the justice. Welcome to Planet to the podcast, build the justice. Build the justice, build the justice, build. Is to add on or do away with it. Justice.
Welcome to Building Justice, a podcast by Sacramento State's Center on Race, Immigration, and Social Justice, Chris J. We explore critical issues affecting our communities with the hopes of creating a healthier and more just world. I'd like to thank our listeners who are tuning in, as well as my colleague and friend, Professor Monica Tuchka, for inviting me to bring this discussion to the podcast. We are delighted to welcome you to this conversation with Dr. Sahar Soderi. My name is Dr. Sahar Razavi. I'm a faculty member in the Department of Political Science, as well as the director of the Iranian and Middle Eastern Studies Center. Our esteemed guest, Dr. Soderi, is an associate professor of sociology at Muhlenberg College. Her research is organized around race, migration, and the Iranian diaspora. Her recently published book, Conditional Belonging, The Racialization of Iranians in the Wake of Anti-Muslim Politics, details Iranians' complex and contradictory relationship with race and belonging through a comparative lens of the Iranian experience in the United States and Germany, focusing particularly on the immigrants' different processes of racialization. We were recently honored to be Dr. Soderi's first stop on her book tour. She came and did a wonderful talk about her book, and I got amazing feedback from students later, who told me that the presentation made them think about so many things in new ways. She went on to give several more successful presentations about the book, and I also happened to see it at the book exhibit at the Middle East Studies Association conference in Montreal, Canada, just a couple of weeks ago. Without further ado, Dr. Soderi, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm really happy to have the chance to talk with you about this wonderful book.
Sarajun, thank you so much for having a conversation with me today about my book, Conditional Belonging. In many ways, the book really documents the lived experiences of Iranians in the United States and Germany, and the motivations from the book really came out of my own lived experiences of being a children of twice migrants, of living in Germany as a child, and then moving to Northern California as an adolescent, and really about how I experienced each nation and how I experienced my identity and my sense of place in each place. And when it came time to really do my dissertation project, which I had really the ideas of which I had already started as an undergrad at UC Davis when I was in honors thesis course as a sociology student. And I started talking to second-generation Iranian kids in the Bay Area. And it was a, you know, and if I were to look back, of course, you know, it was an undergraduate project that one might think as being kind of like insignificant, but it really wasn't, because it really set the foundation of what I was interested in, which is the role of politics. So something that was really interesting to me in speaking with the Iranians in Northern California in the early 2000s was how much they mentioned global politics, how much they mentioned the Iranian Revolution, how much they mentioned the hostage crisis in having impacted their life and how they saw themselves and their larger kind of place in the world. So when it came time years later to do a dissertation process, I had that foundation, that idea that global politics matter. And I think I was really blessed with having an advisor and mentors and professors at Temple University Sociology Department that allowed me to really lean into my lived experiences, that they believed in the power of qualitative research. They believed in the power of narrative. They believed in the power that our lived experiences can actually tell us something really important about the world, right, and our place in it. So when it came time for me to do my dissertation project, I really leaned into my lived experiences, and I wanted to figure out why is it that when I was a child in Germany, I experienced Germany in this particular way. And what was it about us moving to the United States, particularly at the time that we moved to the United States, that had impacted my sense of belonging or my lack of belonging in many ways? And of course, there was the issue of race. Like, what am I in this country? Because in Germany, ever since a kid, I knew I was an Ausländer. I knew I was a foreigner. I knew I was a child of foreigners. And I knew there was not this idea that I would ever become German. But in the United States, when I came here, it was this really interesting thing of, what are you? What are you? And having defined myself in racialized terms. And like, I didn't know what white was, what black was, what Latino was, what, or that I wasn't actually Asian, even though Iran was in Asia. So actually learning racial categories in the United States was a whole socialized thing. I was being socialized into the racial order. And what was clear though, and it's partly because I moved here at the age of 12, I was still a child, but still like moving into adolescence, what was clear to me is that I wasn't white. So even at the age of 12, 13, at the time when Iranians are racially classified as white and other Middle Eastern and North Africans, I didn't think I was white. I didn't feel I was white, but I didn't know what I was. And I think I really leaned into these earlier lived experiences to set the theoretical foundation for the work, right? Right.
Yeah. I think we all get, those of us who are visibly not coded as white, right? We get asked this question all the time growing up here. Even if you're born and raised here, you get asked all the time, what are you? What are you? Are? And we notice that there are certain people who are not asked those questions, right? So even if there are so many people who don't really think that it's salient, they say, why are we even talking about this? If we just stop talking about race, then racism will go away. But the fact is that you can't stop, even if you want to, when you're constantly being asked to identify yourself to your peers, to the people around you. And that's before you even get to some of the material consequences of being coded or read in different ways than the people around you. So I completely appreciate this question. I'm so glad that you and other scholars in this growing body of scholarship are trying to get at this issue of membership in the larger society. You know, our identities are not just how we feel, as we know, they're also how other people perceive us. And that interplay between them, I think, really came out well in your book. And I thought especially the difference between the US and Germany reveals some really important things about the ways that race and identity are related and the way that they function. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah. And I think what's really interesting about what you say is like when we in the United States, ever since I feel like my arrival here, being either associated with Iran, like it's like, where are you from? And then you say, you know, Iran, and then, oh, Iraq. You're like, no, Iran, Iranian revolution. Right. And I remember in Germany, when someone would say, where are you from? And you say Iran, they'd be like, oh, okay. There wasn't that thing. What really mattered more was that you're a foreigner. Mm-hmm. So I think that is something that I try to tease apart in the book. And it's quite intricate because I don't make the argument that Iranians are racialized in one place and not racialized in the other. That's not the argument. The argument I make is they're racialized both in both contexts. It's how they are racialized and how that racialization is impacted by two things. One is the national context, right? How the nation does race, how the nation's racial hierarchies, mm-hmm. nation's history with race and racism, and also whether the global political impact, whether the relationship, the role or the standing of Iran in the world in the large and the larger Middle East, what weight does that have on Iranians, right? Mm-hmm. Where is the weight heavier? I think I'm trying to really break it down. Like if you were to say independent variable, dependent, like if we were really trying to make it as simple as possible, I'm giving you an argument that they're racialized in both places, but that in the United States, the weight, the burden of being Iranian, of being from the Middle East, and of being Muslim, which are all conflated together, right? Mm-hmm. Has a very, it's the one that Iranians point to in racialized. It's the one they feel like is the reason for our discrimination and our marginality. Because here, we the boundary of a foreigner, of being an immigrant, is really not because it's the land of immigrants. America is the land of immigrants. So being an immigrant is not the mark of shame for Iranians. It's the larger politics that come with Iran and the region. Tourism,
what kind of immigrant, right?
Huh?
What kind of immigrant are you, is the question.
What kind of immigrant are you?
Right.
In Germany, it's like you're not going to escape being a foreigner. The racialization of that is deep, and someone who has any dark feature, because they're also the construction of white. What white is based on Aryan, the northern Nordic races of very defined specific features of blue eyes, very pale skin, blonde hair. In the United States, if the Irish can become white, if the Greek can become white, well, clearly Iranians can too. Right. So I think so. Then in Germany, the weight of the racism and the racialization is mostly first and foremost about being a foreigner, being a foreigner from that place, being Muslim. The thing about Iranian is actually not that important. Who cares? Because there, it's not like they associate there. It's sometimes the association with Iran actually ends up being in your benefit, because they're assuming you're Turkish or you're Arab, and they say Iranian. They're like, oh, Iranians, because in Germany, Iranians have a larger history of being the good immigrants, the secular ones,
the model minority,
because that gets swept away in the U.S. The model minority thing. So even though they might have similar SES and several similar levels of integration as we define it in the scholarship, that's not important. And they could be citizens. So here, I'm really also pushing back against the earlier, as you know, wave of literature that said, you secure structural assimilation, you secure the cultural integration, and then you become one of us. And if anything, well, then Iranians should have the highest level of belonging in each place. They've secured all those things. And on top of that, they're mostly secular.
Mm-hmm.
So what else do you want from us? If you were to remember the measures of, like, you become a citizen, you become college educated, you become middle class, and those were the markers, and now you're one of us. Meritocracy.
Mm-hmm.
Meritocracy. You're not just... So I think... In both places, though, particularly in the United States, that has that narrative. Germany doesn't have the narrative of meritocracy.
Mm-hmm.
Germany never promised nobody they'll become German. They said, you can come as a refugee. We're going to abide by the Geneva Convention. We're going to abide by the basic article of the German Constitution. And we're going to give you opportunities for language, give you housing. We're going to allow you to live here. No one said you're going to be a part of us.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Germany never said that and still does not say that. The U.S. says that, though.
Yeah, they definitely do. These national narratives are very powerful in shaping the consciousness of people who are arriving, and also the consciousness of the people who are accepting the new arrival. Right. So and those national narratives are deeply impacted by global politics, just as you said. I mean, if Germany had experienced the hostage crisis, for example, the way that the U.S. did, then it might have been a little bit different. But
embassies would be closed. Those embassies that Iran has in Germany right now will be closed. But Germany, and by the way, something really interesting about Germany, when I did kind of the historical background, and by the way, I'm not a historian, although I love history as a sociologist. Like, who doesn't love history as a sociologist?
Right.
When I look back at the relationship, I was like, oh, there was a certain times when the government of Iran, Reza Shah, was like moving away from the from England and Russia, thinking that they meddled too much. And the reason they preferred the Germans is because they had a reputation of not intervening in other. I was like, look at that. And I'm talking about like, early part of the 20th century, when Iran is kind of like divided. On the north, you got Russia exploiting Iran. In the south, you got the British. So like when the Iranian government is trying to figure out who to do trade deals with, who to sell oil to, and so on and so forth, there was this preference for Germany. That's why the German railroads and so much of German infrastructure, not only were they good at what they did, I'm not saying they didn't have good technical abilities. That's not my point, their expertise. But the other part was they wanted to do those business deals and ties with Germany because Germany had a political reputation of not meddling the way Russia and England did. So it's interesting. The reason I say it's interesting, Germany still, to this day, despite what has happened with the United States and Iran, has continued diplomatic missions, economic ties, and was one of the leading kind of power players in brokering the Iran deal. So I think this sense that, you know, that as long as it doesn't impact Germans directly, they kind of stay out of it. It's interesting how it showed up in the contemporary moment.
Absolutely, yeah.
Historically,
that's so interesting. I didn't think about that. That's very interesting. So as you're describing this, I'm thinking about how the German sort of, I'm curious because I didn't live in Germany as you did. So I'm curious if, so in the US, there's this broad kind of sense among people my age and younger, I would say, and maybe older generations, but I can only speak for myself, my own generation, that we have this broad sense that we are removed from the government, right? That the government isn't really, you know, it's not us. But I think that we can only believe that if we ignore how much politics actually influences our perceptions and our subjective experiences of ourselves and each other. And so I think, I mean, for me, in this case, it's showing up as hostile relations between the U.S. and Iranian governments showing up in the population of the U.S. as anti-Iranian racism. And in Germany, looks like it's not showing up that way.
No, it's not showing up that way. It's not showing up that way. And I think it has a lot to do, again, with the history of that nation, the foreign policy. But the foreign policy, the global political relationship is absolutely important in how that shows up. And I think oftentimes, because like I think the other part that it is the global political stuff is such on a macro level. I think we don't want to believe sometimes the extent of which it matters in the same way the national narratives. Let me tell you why. When I was coming up with some of my hypotheses and my research questions from when I was drawing up my dissertation work, not my chair, but other people had doubts about whether national narratives really mattered in the way I was proposing. Meaning years ago, when I'm kind of coming up with the what is it called? The foundation for the work. One of the things, because the title of my dissertation was National Narratives in Global Politics. Mm-hmm. I was interested in the national narrative. And then, of course, you keep expanding on the work. But the dissertation kind of provided that big foundation for the book. Mm-hmm. So in it, I made a point, global politics matter, but national narratives. And I wondered, I had doubters, but I had people who were a little bit skeptical over, are these national narratives, these ideologies really that important? And you know how it came up? I found how it was important, not just in the narratives Iranians told me, in the narratives Iranians in Germany told me about Iranians in the U.S.
Really?
Insane. And it's in the book. I have it. In saying, it's not like Germany is the United States where everyone can become American. Mm-hmm. It's not like you can wear a hijab in America and still run for political office, or say it about Canada. So it was very clear that Iranians in Germany had also internalized the idea of the United States as a liberal democracy and Canada as a system of multiculturalism. And it was very clear how Iranians had internalized things about Germany, because some Iranians I interviewed were first refugees in Germany right after the Iraq War and the revolution. They couldn't get a visa into the U.S., which is also what Iranians did a lot. At some time, they went to another nation.
Sure.
Right? As a stepping stone. And the gentleman had gotten a visa, legal residency for him and Mr. Mansour and his family. In the book, I cite him through International Human Rights Organization. After 2 years of being in Germany and securing that residency, he makes the next move of coming to the U.S. And I asked him, well, after all these years, you had secured residency. Why not stay in Germany? He said, Germany is only for Germans.
Really?
So
interesting.
It's not that national narratives just matter on a local level. They're being internalized at the larger level of what Iranians believe life for those is like here and what people believe life is like there. So Iranians in Germany also felt that U.S. was a better choice for feeling more equal, feeling more belonging. And Iranians in the U.S. also, and by the way, it wasn't just narratives. They had family in Germany. Sure. They had family in Sweden. They had family in the Netherlands who constantly told them, I'm a doctor here, but I still get called a dirty foreigner, particularly after the refugee crisis in 2015. That's when things really swung. And I think I just want to say, whoever is listening to this as a researcher, I say this a lot, and I keep saying, I said to my students, hone in on your own intuition and your instincts. Folks thought I didn't need to do the follow-up work to write the book, which is probably correct, meaning that I didn't need to go back into the field to do the follow-up. But I want to tell you, I was precisely correct in doing that. Because if you have some theoretical, you have a feeling, global politics matter, these shifts matter, ebbs and flows matter. But then something so important and so important for migration crises, for everything else, like the Trump presidency happens, like a Muslim ban, like the certification, like Germany accepting 1.2 million refugees. If you think these larger scale events don't have tremors and ramifications on the ground. So the reason I returned was because I found it to be important. I didn't have any money for that work. I just kind of cobbled together money every summer in between teaching, you know, heavy teaching load, going back to the field and of course succeeding in speaking to a portion of those people I had spoken to. And it was honestly, Sarah-Jun, the follow-up interviews that showed me, oh, you were right. Oh, you were right. Not only were you right, not only were you right in what you found, that these things matter, but the intensity had gone up. And not only could I kind of pinpoint that the intensity had gone up because of what Iranians were experiencing, some were having a shift in consciousness. Because I was speaking to the same people I had spoken to. These are not new people. These are people who I'd already spoken to at length. So 5 years later, you come back and they're telling you, sad, this is the first time I don't feel like an American anymore. Sad, they're really coming for us. Or the woman saying, I finally went and got U.S. citizenship. She's been for 25 years. She never wanted to be a citizen for various reasons. She was a green card holder. Why is it that 5 years later I talk to her and she's saying, I got a citizen, I want to be deported? So clearly the Trump presidency matters, because it's you for 5 years. What is the condition on the ground that compels you to become a citizen now? Mm-hmm. Or the Iranian woman, second generation in Germany, who used public transportation all her life and all of a sudden gets a driver's license because she's attacked 2 times on the train. So now I need to drive, right? Like, my point is, I was also able to document the shift from belonging to I don't belong.
And actually, that brings me to my next question. I was going to ask you as we wrap up the title itself, Conditional Belonging. Love the title. I wanted to ask, I mean, the second part of the title directly points to the shift that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. But the first part, I wanted to ask, so many people have asked me, my students have asked me, what does she mean by that? Does she mean that there are conditions under which Iranians feel membership, genuine membership in the broader society? And if so, what are those conditions? And which Iranians are those that feel that? By recency of immigration, by socioeconomic status, et cetera. And that's a little bit of my own interest as well. That's one of the questions I'm getting out in my current project around race and racial identity. Which ones of us are we talking about? Right? So I was wondering if you could.
Very good. Thank you so much. That's actually the first time I've been asked it, but in this way. So there's actually two for me. And as you said it, something clicked in my head. So I just want to, it's the first time I'm really being asked. So please excuse me if I'm kind of all over the place. I actually see two points in that. There's, like, meaning to me, conditional belonging has two There's two, not versions, there's two explanations for the title. One is there are conditions under which you can belong. So in the United States, the condition is hiding your identity. I mean, you can't belong if every time you walk around saying Iranian, 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 they say, where are you from? Iranian. Oh, the revolution. And then you're made to feel like you are either an Islamist or a hostage. So one of the conditions of belonging in the United States is hiding part of your identity. And what's that called? Simmering down on the qualities that make you too much from over there. I think another condition of belonging in the United States, and this doesn't just apply to the to Iranians, to a lot of people, is following the middle class upward mobility model. Right? That's another one. So the conditions upon belonging in the United States is being another one for me. And again, it's not here. You're asking me, so I'm really, and again, I don't think this just applies to the United States, is really believing to a part in this political system that we got going on, that this is the best system. This is the most democratic system. This is the best system. Capitalism is the best economic. Like, so those are the conditions. The minute you start questioning things, what do you start feeling? Forget that, just as Iranian, in general, as a member of this society, the minute we become critical, is exactly when now you can feel not belonging, I want to say, in the larger nation, but find shared community. But that shared community is based on similar values. Mm-hmm. But Iranians haven't really felt that, have they? And that's the question. Have Iranians some sort of sustain? I mean, if it's then send me an invitation, I would love to see. Because by the way, I want to ask you another reason where they belong from. One of the very last questions on my interview guide was, how do we create a community and sense of belonging among Iranians? Sahar, without me telling you, please tell me what you think. And I'm not going to ask you about the German. Tell me about what you think the majority of Iranians told me about that question. I'm just going to quiz you, right? I'm going to ask you. So what is the best way for us to create community and belonging together? What do you think they said?
That is such an amazing question, to try to project out what I think they would say.
Yeah, so what do you think the majority of Iranians at both first and second, but especially first, but first and second? Just give me an overall feeling that you have, because the answer to that was.
I mean, I feel like creating a sense of community among Iranians would require that we actually all get together on a regular basis and spend time getting to know each other, because we're all kind of, in Farsi, you say paratende, right? All in different places, doing different things. Mm-hmm. But I guess the second thing I would imagine is, you know, we're like food obsessed. So like to get together to eat, I don't know.
You're such a sociologist. I wish that's one of them said. You know what they also said?
What?
Good luck. Let me know when you find out.
Oh, my goodness.
You know what that means? That means Iranians, what do you think they believe about their culture that we don't have?
That long. That's so sad.
It was very sad. Most of it was good luck. Maybe it was food, but the point was that Iranians belonging, it was a lot of laughing at and like laughing sarcasm. So now in Germany it was a little different, but my point is that tells me something else about like belonging, right? Like so so again, but I don't want to take, so one is what are the conditions, but in the sense of what I'm saying in the book is the conditions upon Iranians belonging. The same things that make Iranians feel excluded are exactly the things that keep him from experiencing belonging. That's one. Mm-hmm. Second, now you're asking me, well, if you were to zoom in and say, what are the particularities? Who is more likely to belong? I think it's also connected. The people who are more likely to feel that they belong are either those who, in my opinion, you know, and this is my opinion here, okay? This is my opinion. One, I think they definitely have to be middle class in both nations. They have to be more highly educated. They have to have, some money and ways to make things work for them. Or they would think that their entire decision to migrate was BS. I could have just had that in Iran. So there has to be some of it. But another one I think has to be their ability to really shut off global politics and not think about too much of the loss and be in real touch with what's really going on. Because I think most Iranians that are in touch will tell you, they say, we did all these sacrifices. We came here, we did the best we could. But you know, I don't belong here, but do I also belong there? Where do I belong? So this issue of being in exile seems to also get more intense as they get older. It seems like the Iranians I spoke to, particularly first generation, in the first 20 years of their life in the United States, it was go, go, go. It was securing their basic needs and trying to create a good foundation for their kids. But something about hitting post-60s and getting older, they have a rethinking of, was it really worth it? How much did I lose for all this? And I think that gets Iranians then in this thing of, nah, I can't belong, because this is not a two-way street. And what they mean is the United States is not working for them in the two-way street. Mm-hmm. Even those who want it, for example, the basic things like an Iran deal and sanctions, like they are really distraught by their inability to be tax-paying Americans. They've reached all these levels. They've been here since they were 18. Now they're 70 years old. They spent 52 years in America. They know nothing about Iran. They haven't been to Iran. And I think they get frustrated that even at the basic level, American politicians will listen to them. So I think the thing about belonging is so complex.
Mm-hmm.
Think about so complex, and there's multi. So I think the issue that's a little complicated for Iranians, and I can speak for other groups, but I'm saying for Iranians, is not only do they not feel that they belong sometimes to the places that they immigrate to, the question becomes, do they actually also feel belonging to the Iranians that are there? So it's like a double exclusion, like, right?
Especially for those who left before the revolution. They feel like there's really no home to go back to anyway, even if they wanted to.
No.
Because the country was completely turned upside down. So there was there's a loss of home and a loss of belonging to the society that produced you.
Which is why when some of them, after many years, the few that go back, they are very, Iranis. And they're not even saying in a bad or good way. They're just saying the mannerisms, for example, like this woman says, I don't understand none of their slang.
Oh, yeah.
I don't understand nothing they really say. Yeah. They thought they're going to walk into a society of everyone highly politicized, and they're surprised that the young people are sometimes checked out, that right. They're just about making money and securing resources. I mean, that's one thing that I went to Iran. I was like, oh, I have it all upside down. There's just this imaginary you have that's informed by narratives in your ear from family and exile stories. And you go back to Iran, you say, oh, there's a lot of similarities. I mean, I was, got to tell you, I went back when Obama was president a few times, and I was quite shocked at young folks. Like, I don't know. I have this view that they're all like, rah, 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 and anti-American, rah, rah, rah. I don't like the West. No, that's the West. They're over here telling me, like, they didn't even want to hear my doom and gloom stories about it. Sometimes they feel like, what do you even complain about? Like, I say all that to say the being disconnected from there, being disconnected from here, from your own local community of Iranians that you don't feel like. And then you're also at the higher level disconnected. So I think, but those who can try to approximate belonging, I think those who can shift and shape themselves into some things. But,
and that's the racial flexibility.
Yeah, that's the racial flexibility. That's the tonight. That, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this lonely to think about. It feels very isolating to think about this, that there is such a relatively large contingent of Iranian immigrants here, first and second generation, who feel like there's no place that they belong in the world. And that sense of exile, I think a lot of people, scholars and community members and activists, they've tried to get at that in some of the discussions that they've had and the research that they've done. But I think lately, there's sort of a new wave of research coming up.
Oh, yeah.
That I think your book is part of, that people are trying to really drill down on what that means and what kind of political processes shape our lives. And so for me as a political scientist, I really, that's my jam, right? To figure out how political processes that and global flows kind of shape our identities and our lives.
Right.
And really, I'm really happy that you wrote this book.
Thank you, Sajun. I'm happy that you're doing this work and you're a part of this growing field of scholarship. Before we go out, I want to tell you something else that's not in the book that I am interested in the future. I want to hone in on some more is the relationship between trauma and belonging, trauma, because we're all carrying a lot of trauma. And I got to say, before we leave, every time something happens, particularly in that part of the world, we actually relive trauma, which is why some of our elders right now, whenever there's a conflict of any war, of any kind of thing, people aren't only thinking, like when they see things, they are reminded of a lot of other things. So there's a triggering effect, the reawakening of trauma. So I think for Iranians, this is in a lot of other groups, but I think for Iranians, we don't talk about trauma a lot. We don't talk about trauma a lot. I don't think most of you, don't talk about trauma, but there's a, we try to filled with it. And I think that's why Zanzendegi Azadi, if I may, the outrage we felt in this in-group attacking is based off that trauma. When you can't pull something up, it just stuck. And I think for Iranians, I'm going to be honest with you, I think the sense of they're stuck in place. They feel like they're stuck. They're just stuck. What's going to come? It's almost like every day you're waiting. And I think there's a level of trauma there. And I think trauma has an impact on belonging. I think trauma has an impact on social membership, feeling like a soul. So there's just so much said. And I just think there's a lot more work, but, you know, to be done. But I think it's a very worthwhile thing to explore, right?
That's so interesting. I'm not the person to do the research in trauma because I don't have the training, but that is such an interesting question, and I can't wait for that book to come out. I really want to see what the answers and then further questions are that are generated out of that.
So thank you so much also for giving some of us the opportunity to come and share our work in this way, in this very conversational way, which I really appreciate. Like, this is kind of my jam. Like, this is the way
I love it.
This is the way I generally would like to converse with people. And
No, it's the best way for me as well. I'm so glad. Thank you so much for talking with me today for this podcast episode.
I'm so happy that we have the chance to have these kinds of conversations. And I think that our community, our students, our campus community all really benefit from this type of work, this kind of research. To all of our listeners, thank you for listening. We hope our ongoing conversations spark understandings, empathies, and motivation to join the struggle for a better future for all. You just listened to the Building Justice podcast. The information contained in this podcast, including its title and description, represent the views and opinions of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of Sacramento State, Chris J., and or the Building Justice podcast committee.
All the penalties and the rewards based on the actions. Now, time for building justice. Building justice. Time for